This is the Screw the Naysayer Show, where we interview people that are world-class, from thought leaders like Seth Godin to New York Times bestsellers to hugely successful entrepreneurs, where we figure out what makes them tick and unpack it for you to do the same. Guys, before we jump into today's episode, I just want to give a big shout out to all the great entrepreneurs and wannabe entrepreneurs who tune in every week. Your support is making it possible for me to attract world-class guests. We've got some great names coming up, and it's all because of you. Thanks also to those of you who have taken a moment to leave a review for my show. And if you share Screw the Naysayers with your friends, take a screenshot and send it to me by email, tim@screwthenaysayers.com, or simply tag me. I'll be doing a draw every month for a $50 Amazon card to thank loyal listeners who are helping us spread our message of positivity and wanting to kick those naysayers to the curb. Now for today's interview. Hey, everybody. Tim Allison here, host of the Screw the Naysayers podcast, and I'm delighted to have with me today Natalie Kairosh. So Natalie's life changed in a nine-minute span on Friday, March the 4th. I'm surprised that she's, you know, able to even hear that date without... reacting in 2016. 8 months pregnant, Natalie was standing in broad daylight near a busy suburban center when she was stabbed 24 times with a 12-inch carving knife. She suffered horrific life-critical wounds to her major organs and main arteries, but after heroic intervention by bypassers and police and an air ambulance rescue that truly saved her life, she beat the odds, as did her child. So, but of course, not without life-changing physical and emotional challenges and damages. So in the 4 years since that attack, Natalie has started up two businesses, Natalie Q Inspire Limited, where she works as a motivational speaker and a consultant, and Inspire to Quit Blades. It's a community interest company that focuses on tackling the rising epidemic in knife crime through sharing her experiences as the victim to at-risk youth groups. Her best-selling book, Still Standing, documents the before, during, as well as the important rebuild of her life. Natalie, I can't thank you enough for joining us today on Screw the Naysayers.
Oh, well, thank you, Tim. Thank you for asking me. It's amazing. Thank you.
Well, there you go. So, same question I ask all my guests at the outset. Natalie, when you hear the word naysayers, what is the first thought or story that comes into your head?
I think what it is people think that they have the answers to everything. And the thing that I always think is that people form opinions, and okay, you know, they might be based on their own experiences, but people believe that things should be a certain way or things should go a certain way. And it's great to be able to sometimes beat those odds and those thoughts and those mindsets and be able to say, do you know what? No, yeah. No, I'm not going that way.
I think, and I've had several guests, or not several, I've had dozens of guests on this show who have faced really, you know, crazy adversity. Yours is certainly up there, but I won't say in its own sense it's any more shocking than several of the others that, you know, guests that have been on here. Horrible things that I don't think, unless someone's faced that level of adversity, that it's really possible to understand. I think you just, you know, you can try to get your mind around it. But one of the things that, you know, that I've observed in people that have faced big adversity in their life is it gives real clarity in the way you just answered that question. And I think sometimes maybe we need to cut people some slack and realize that those that are not yet aware of that, they're sort of projecting their own limiting beliefs and things like that, partly because they either have avoided situations where they would ever get challenged, or quite simply just, you know, nothing's happened yet. Universe has a habit.
I think the thing is that people base everything on their own experience, don't they? It might be what they've read. It might be the values they're brought up with by their families. You know, and we can all believe, well, we do believe, you know, our way of thinking is the way forward because we have to justify everything that we do. And some people do get very caught in that. And it's not a criticism, people. It's how we all biologically are sort of wired, I guess.
And certainly, you know, I guess. I mean, the biological bit, I wonder a little bit. But I will certainly acknowledge that from early days, when we get into our school systems, it's certainly how we condition people to think. And, you know, we're taught very early on to compare ourselves to other people. I mean, you got better grades in school and, you know, than someone else did, or, you know, these kind of things. You're praised for, you know, and some things. I mean, I think, for example, competition in sports can be very healthy because it can learn us about, you know, we can learn about what it takes to prepare, and that sometimes even if you did your absolute best, you might just get beat by somebody who's more physically gifted or something, but you might also lose to somebody less talented.
Yeah.
Because you didn't prepare, but anyway, so let's get to your story, Natalie. I mean, and I think we're going to only have about 25 minutes here. I don't want to spend much time really at all on the event. I mean, it's inconceivable. But just clarify a couple things for it that weren't in the introduction. Like, who was involved in the attack, and what what did you go through in those early days and sort of pulling through?
Yeah, so with my attack, I mean, as you said, it happened on a Friday. It was an ordinary Friday afternoon, and I was jumped from behind by somebody who was in disguise. Therefore, I thought I was some random victim, that whether it was somebody with some severe issues, problems, that had randomly picked on a pregnant woman because I looked vulnerable. I actually thought I was being mugged to start with. The attack progressed, as you said, for 9 minutes, and it was a very violent attack. And I spent those 9 minutes predominantly conscious and fighting for my life bitterly to the absolute bitter end. At one point, I broke free from the attacker. Two passers-by were struggling with him. We were all on the pavement. I broke free. And he actually was arrested, the attacker, at the scene and taken off. And I was airlifted, as you say, quite rightly, to hospital, straight into theatre. And it wasn't really till the next day that the confirmation came of who the attacker was. And the attacker was actually my partner. And this was a man who I'd known since I was 15. We went to a very British grammar school. He went to an all-boys school. I went to the all-girls school nearby. And so both good education, good backgrounds, went on to university. My best friend married his best friend. The group stayed together. And there had been no warning. People always think, so I'd gone from a very happy bubble. We lived together. We were planning our wedding. This was our first child together. I'd had two from a previous marriage. He'd never had kids. And all of a sudden, my world fell apart within a matter of hours. I was now fighting for my life in critical care. My baby was in a different hospital. We both had life-changing injuries. And I have a police officer by my bedside saying, it's your partner. And there was no logic. I mean, I remember mentally crumbling, lying on that bed in critical care, tears streaming down my face, thinking it just can't be. It was a premeditated attack. He was in full disguise. And the preceding days were very dark. More and more information started to filter through. And I was desperate to speak to him because I was so, but he's my partner, and he left home as normal that morning. He'd gone to work and I'd spoken to him on the phone. I was actually on my way to meet him when the attack took place. He arranged for us to go to the bank together, hence why I was going to the town centre. And I just couldn't put it together. I was like, and the police were like, Nasty, you can't speak to him. You cannot speak to him. And there was no logic to it. And it was a very dark place because I'm very open about the fact, you know, especially in the first months even, there were times I had suicidal thoughts where I just thought, I can't keep fighting. Because every day you wake up and the pain hits you, the physical pain, the mental pain, the memories of the attack, the flashbacks. The fact I have police officers coming to my hospital room to interview me on camera, and I'm there sat on a ward where I can see other mothers with their babies and their families all happy, and I'm sat there broken, thinking, how's this happened to me? I came from, I had a good job, I had a good life, I had a nice house, and this shouldn't have happened to me. And it was like a series of grief. It was the true grief cycle, the anger, the lack of acceptance, you know, the tears, the denial, everything we talk about, classic grief cycle, I experienced. And you though get to a point that I just thought, I've got and I got sink. You kind of hit this point of I can either be sorry, just lie here feeling sorry for myself, and everybody would have understood if I what did.
Yeah.
Or I can get up, I can put my makeup on, do my hair, look like mum, even if I don't feel like it. And if I can put on this face and my kids can see that's mum and she's getting up and she's functioning, that was what was important. And I never forget a friend of mine who lives in Spain. She flew over to be with me, and she said to sort of family around me, should the thing that always astounded me with Natalie was I would see her with the children and she'd be acting normal mum, functioning, getting everything ready, getting them to school, getting them sorted. And then I saw as soon as they went to bed,
yeah,
I just saw this pale face suddenly appear. The tears would come once they were asleep, and I saw the real broken side. But she said as soon as the children were up, there was no sign. And that's how I functioned, Tim. That's how I had to function. I gave myself little windows that I would allow myself to cry where it wasn't in front of my kids. And as time progressed, I started setting myself challenges of things I was going to do that could help me get through it.
What's going through my mind, and it's maybe a crazy thought, but I mean, you were able to, you know, give yourself that time for a just reason. And, you know, in other words, you know, you, if that makes any sense, like, you know, there was a thing, you know, a mom, dad, or this thing, I'm going to do this for my children. And yet then when you took your, and that would have given you a little respite, I would expect, from some of those emotions. It would have crashed down afterwards. I can't help but reflect on some of the others. You know, a person that's coming to mind is one of my earliest guests was Madeline Black, and she held everything inside for, you know, I forget how many decades before she told anybody. Well, that's not true. She told, you know, but nobody believed her. Yeah. And then she just literally held it inside. So for Madeline, it was different. She was masking things from the world. Like, she didn't want anybody to know that inside was this hot mess, for, you know, whatever is the right word for it. It's not the right word, but you know what I'm getting at. Whereas, I don't know. You know, I know it's crazy to find gifts and things, but I wonder when it was so visible in terms of the attack, and also because your kids were, you know, right there and in so need, whether that might have played a role in your finding the strength to start your recovery.
Yeah, I think the thing is that mine was so public, and that was actually a very hard thing to deal with. So things were almost taken out of my control. So while I was still lying in critical care, the British press had gone onto things like my Facebook account and taken photos from it. So on tack on the Friday, I'm lying in the coma till the Saturday. I'm still in critical care Sunday, Monday. My ex-husband, the father of my two older children, who's a very good man, he's still very good friends, he took the kids on the Monday just to go to a local shop to get some food. And he said he walked in, and on the paper, newspaper stand, every paper had my photograph sitting on the front of it. And it was a photograph taken from a family holiday. So it was a photograph of me, a photograph of my then partner, my ex-partner, Bobby, who carried out the attack. And even the photograph had my two children with their faces pixelated out. So my poor kids were just faced with this, you know, first photo of mother stabbed. And I think I could see the trauma. I could see the effect on them. I could see their, you know, when they visit, they didn't see me for a week. We made the decision they wouldn't come to the hospital at first to see me while I was still in critical care, because I had tubes and everything coming out of me. And I remember that first time I saw them, they came to the hospital and their little faces were so wide-eyed. They'd heard people talking about it in the street, you know, people creating whatever story, why did he do it, all this. And I just thought, I owe it to my kids to hold it together, because they are being bombarded. This is totally public. I've got no way of hiding from this. Yeah. It's on every newspaper, every main newspaper in, you know, the British Isles had it, national news, local news. And I thought, I've just got to stay strong here, because they need me to be strong, because this trauma is not just mine, it's theirs.
Yeah, I hear you. Listen, I want to get on to some positive stuff here, because your book is called Still Standing. But and when you wrote it, you know, when did you publish that book?
So my book got launched last June, and it's been great. It's actually gone to, I need to get it over to Canada. I must It has gone into different countries across the world, which is amazing, and it's just been translated to Estonian, which is very random, and I'm very pleased about. But it got published. It started as notes. So I've got a funny story about the fact I was lying in hospital. This was my second week in hospital. My left hand got very badly damaged in the attack, and I'm left-handed. So I've got it completely strapped up. So I'm a one-handed single mom of three. Really great position to be in, as you can imagine, with a newborn baby who's got issues and problems with feeding and all the rest of it. And my sister came in with a notebook, and she's a qualified counsellor, notebook and a pen. And she goes, I want you to write down your thoughts and your feelings. I think I told her where to stick that notebook at the time, because I just looked at her and went, are you kidding me? I can't write. I am trying to look after a newborn baby in this hospital room who can't feed. And you're giving me a notebook. And she just said, just stick with it. So she did. She always remembers I was quite rude about it. And some very choice words. But actually, as the weeks progressed, I started to use my other hand, start to make some notes. That became a journal. Yeah. And the more I found out about my ex-partner was actually a man I totally trusted and believed in. I found that there were a lot of lies, a lot of things I didn't know about. And all of this stuff started to unfold. And I became like a private investigator of my own story, in effect, because I was like, I'm going to find out more. I want to know more. And I have a great psychologist who in the end said, Natalie, you've got to give yourself a break at some point. You know, I know you want the truth and you want to face up to everything, but, you know, this is tough on you. You're finding out all this stuff. And I started to write it out. And it was so unbelievable, parts of it. People kept saying to me, Natalie, you've got to write this up. So it started as a journal, a diary, then my own discoveries and my own journey. The book takes you through the before, what life was like before, it takes you through the tap, but the important after. So the discovery about all these facts about him, but also I was very honest and very frank about my own emotional recovery. And people said, you've got to publish it. And the book takes you through to the point where I face him in prison. So I went to the prison to face him. It took me a lot of fighting. I was determined. Yeah. I told you when I was in hospital, I was determined he was going to speak to me.
Yeah.
I had to wait over a year. And a lot of fighting because the prison wouldn't let me go in. And I got to, in the end, spend a whole day face to face with him. And the book takes you through to that point. And I had somebody at a talk that I gave at a charity do. And they said to me, I hear you're writing a book. And they put me in touch with this publisher to give me some advice. And before I knew it, I had a publishing deal.
Well, here's what I want to say to you. And I have not read the book yet, but I think you're doing a lot more than just standing right now. Like, you know, here you are less than 4 years, you know, from something as dramatic as that. Not only, you know, obviously got your family situation back together, you know, with your kids. And if I'm not mistaken, you is there another partner?
There is another partner. There is a big rock on the dodgy hand, a large
rock on a beautiful hand. So here's what I in the time we have left, you know, Natalie, you know, obviously you're doing some pretty inspiring things. So what lessons have you learned that you could, you know, share in the next, you know, 5 or 10 minutes with us about, you know, when we're faced with, you know, these, you know, big adversity and things that just, I forget what your words were. I think it was something like you just felt crushed or whatever. But when you just feel like I can't go on or whatever, obviously you and so many other, you know, amazing, inspiring people, sometimes I worry that people hear these stories and they think, oh yeah, well, she can do it. But I mean, look, she's superwoman or something like that. And yet we're all like, it's not the case, eh? Like everybody has this within them if they pull it out. So what can you share, you know, that others could, you know, could benefit from right now who might be, you know, needing some thoughts and some advice on.
Because the one thing I say is all of us have been through adversity in our life, all of us. If you speak to anybody, they have gone through a tough situation. And one thing that I always get passionate about is people say, yeah, but my tough situation is nothing like yours. And I think everybody's tough situation is tough to them. Whether it's a divorce, whether it's witnessing your parents' divorce, your own divorce, whether it's child's illness, your own illness, it is tough. It is really tough. And what we all need to do is we need to reflect on the fact we have got through that. We need to reflect, hold on, we've got a lot more strength and a lot more resilience than we think. The biggest thing for me was as you say, I was broken. I was in hospital. And I reflected about the fact that I had a very good job in the pharmaceutical industry. I were brilliant, and they've been exceptionally good to me since. But I reflected and thought, that job is not actually what I want to do. My value was I wanted to go on and help and support people. I want to go and do something. I want to make a difference in the world. It doesn't have to earn me loads of money, but I'm going to walk away from this big salary job with a nice company car and the health insurance, and I'm going to set up on my own. And finding that value, and that gave me the passion and the drive to go on and do what I do. So I work, as you say, with young people who are at risk. I talk to them about knife crime. We have a quite horrific problem that's escalating out of control here in the UK with knife crime. And we have young people. We had a 14-year-old stab two people the other day here in the Midlands, where I live in England. And it's just unbelievable what we're seeing. And I show them the direct experience. And I don't earn anywhere near, at the moment, the money that I did earn. I could easily go back to the pharmaceutical industry if I wanted to. I was in it for 19 years. But I won't, because my passion is about connecting with people and giving them the hope and giving them the inspiration. When I do the motivational speaking, I have women, I have men that come up to me and say, do you know what? I've hit some really low times, but I can see there is a way out. And that is what it is. I say to anybody listening to this, reflect on your value. What is it that would really mean the most to you? And no matter what you're in, you can work towards doing that, and that will give you your spark. I could have died within hours on that Friday afternoon, and I'd have died doing a job I didn't actually really have a passion about. And that is awful to think. A great salary, everything else, I ticked all the boxes, the good house, the good car, etc., etc., but I wasn't actually integrally fulfilled. And I'd say for anybody, reflect on your value, reflect on your importance, and I tell you what, you will find a strength and a resilience in you that you wouldn't believe.
Yeah, that's such amazing advice, and Natalie, it's pretty timely advice right now too, because one of the things I've observed on this show, 275 episodes or so in, is that most people that have come on this show that have done remarkable things have faced some major infrastructure rattling event. It could be something as you know, like yours. It could be a health problem, a heart attack, a divorce, a lost your relationship, a lost job. I mean, there's all these different things, but you'll see these moments when people will look back and say, well, it was then that I woke up and realized that what I was doing just didn't have purpose. And I faced my own mortality, or I saw it either through my own health or through somebody that I loved. And I realized, well, you know, I'm not going, in your words, I don't want to die knowing that I was doing a job that all that time that I didn't want to do. You know, never minimizing the impact of COVID-19 on individuals. The loss of life is horrific and sad. And certainly there are people that are facing a significant economic hardship and everything else. And I never, ever minimize that. But when I get sort of up, look at it from the big picture, it's almost as if the universe just gave us all a big swat in the side of the head and said, here is your group in infrastructure rattling event, because too many of you are being too damn stupid and not really, you know, you're caught up in chasing money. We're destroying the planet. We're permitting violent crimes to go by and just sort of rolling our shoulders and saying, well, what can we do about it? So I don't know what your thoughts are, but it kind of feels that way to me, as if there's a power at work here that just sort of did that. So it's in that sense, there's an opportunity.
We are going through a worldwide trauma. And as you quite rightly say, unfortunately, so many people, it takes a large trauma to create change. I'd love it that people could find that change and that desire to change before that. But I'm hoping that the positive things that will come out of COVID-19, as we talk today, is obviously we're in the middle of it, or we're pulling out of it, maybe, hopefully, is that people will reflect upon the value. They'll have spent more time with their family. That might be a good or a bad thing, let's be honest. Locked in with your family for many weeks can be very trying. I've been doing homeschooling with my kids. I think the teachers of my children require medals after having homeschooled myself. But I think it's a time to, hopefully reflect on values. But any point in life, we should be able to. It's like the New Year's resolution, isn't it? Why do people wait till December the 31st to say, right, from tomorrow, I'm not going to drink as much. Tomorrow, I'm not going to smoke. Tomorrow, I'm going to start a health regime. Tomorrow, I'm going to look for a new job. December 31st shouldn't be that point. Trauma shouldn't be that point. You can do it anytime. I know it sounds cheesy and I sound like one of these people like, rah, 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 you can do it anytime. But it is true. Don't wait for, I was touching death, literally. And it took that much for me, which is frustrating in itself. Live your best life. What we can see from COVID-19, a virus came out of the blue. It took so many lives. It's taking so many lives. It is beyond heartbreaking what's happened. But that's how precious life is. That's how vulnerable we are within our life pattern. Anything could happen. So you have to do it now.
Yeah, very well said. Natalie, for people who want to, you know, get a copy of your book and learn more about you and the things you got going on with your companies and all that kind of stuff, what's the best place for people to find you?
So if they look up on things like Amazon and sort of the larger bookstores, and you'll look up Still Standing and you'll find Natalie Queiroz, or if you look on my website, which is qinspire.co.uk, obviously over here in the UK, then you'll find me. I did a TEDx talk back in December. So if you go on the TED channel, you'll be able to put Natalie Queiroz Still Standing, Make It Count. If you just put Still Standing, Make It Count, if you can't spell my surname, that's fine. trust me, I know. It took me years to even learn to spell it when I was a kid. It's a terrible name to have to learn when you're a child. But Portuguese dad. And so go look at my TED talk, please. That'd be great. You can see the story. You can see how it unfolded. qinspire.co.uk, and as I say, look up for the book Still Standing, which I should have had the copy here, but it's over over on the other side of the room. But
perfect. Yeah. Well, we will put all of those links on the episode page for this event. And Natalie, I can't thank you enough for joining me today.
Thank you very much. Oh, and LinkedIn linking with me.
Okay, we'll add LinkedIn to the context. Thanks, Natalie. Hey guys, thanks for hanging out. You can see all the show notes for this episode at screwthenaysayers.com/podcast. Also, don't forget to subscribe for free at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And while you're over there, it would mean the world to me if you could leave us a rating or a review. The best way to do that is by going over to ratethispodcast.com/STN. So thanks very much, guys. Have an awesome day. And remember, screw the naysayers. They suck anyways.